Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for November's Neurology Club webinar. I'm very pleased to welcome our speaker for today, European and RCVS specialist in veterinary neurology, Johnny Plessas. Thank you, Johnny. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Great. Hi everyone, and thanks, Amit Jo, for the wonderful introduction. So it's an exciting day for me because we're going to talk about a favorite subject. We're going to talk about cerebellar diseases, and it's not going to be just a usual presentation about cerebellar anatomy and cerebellar physiology. It's going to be a very practical case-based guide. We have some exciting and interesting cases to present today, but of course, we're going to just briefly, we're going to talk a little bit about where is the cerebellum and what does it normally do. So, first of all, let's start with the location of the cerebellum. Most of you might be familiar with where the cerebellum is. You can see it on this slide is highlighted green. It's in the location of the coda fossa. It's just above the brainstem. So this is the brainstem here. And here is just behind the occipital lobes of the forebrain. And sometimes you hear neurologists and other people, when we are concerned about increased intracranial pressure, that we might have cerebellar herniation. So what we really describe as cerebellar herniation most of the times is the caudal cerebellar herniation. So here we have, at this level, we have the foramen magnum, and when there is increased pressure in the rostral part of the brain, the cerebellum is pushed caudally and it starts herniating through the foramen magnum. And this is very dangerous and life-threatening because it can start compressing the brainstem, which is a very important structure of the brain. So this is pretty much, just a basic anatomy and basic description of the cerebellum. And now we can talk about really what does it do and how do we normally divide it. So let's go to the next slide. So the role, first of all, what does it do? The role of the cerebellum is very just it's complex. It has many different functions. We really don't know exactly all the functions of the cerebellum, but we believe that is, we know a little bit of what can it do. And the main role of the cerebellum is really to initiate, just to, not to initiate movement, but to coordinate movement. So it's all about movement and all about coordination. So the cerebellum doesn't normally initiate movement. This is happening in the different motor centers in the forebrain and other parts of the brain, but definitely not in the cerebellum, or at least that's what we believe. So the main role is really to coordinate. It receives that information from the brain, and normally that information, it's a bit chaotic. So the cerebellum puts everything in the right order, and then we have a well-coordinated movement, which can affect the movements of the head and of the rest of the body, of course. So as we discussed, it receives all the information from the brain, and then it fine-tunes that information, and then it projects that to relevant motor centers, and then, of course, so we have initiation of movement by contraction of muscles. So based on that, if there is a lesion in the brain, you expect that we're going to have a loss of that coordination, and this is what we normally describe as ataxia. And specifically, when it comes to the cerebellum, is a cerebellar ataxia, which we're going to go into great and better details afterwards about really how do we recognize this type of ataxia. So let's look a little bit at the different parts of the cerebellum. So we discuss where it is, what is the main function. However, we can have more specific functions depending on which part of the cerebellum can be affected. So as you can see here, we've got the vermis. So this is the vermis here. So the middle part of the cerebellum is the vermis. And then we have the two hemispheres. So this is one hemisphere here, and then this is the other one. So pretty much the sides of the cerebellum are the hemispheres, the middle is the vermis, and this is a quite important little part underneath, is what we call the floculonodular lobe. So it might be a very little lobe just underneath. Most of the time it's hidden. It's very difficult to actually find this underneath the cerebellum, but we're going to talk a little bit about it later because it has a very specific function. So this is something that we're going to go into detail later. So we talk about the different parts of the cerebellum, the vermis, the hemispheres, and the floculonodular lobe, but let's talk a little bit about what kind of function they've got. We're not going to go into great detail because this can be quite complex in neurology, but generally, the vermis has a spinocerebellar function, so it tends to just control movements and coordinate movements that they're associated more with the spinal cord, so it projects further down in the spinal cord. And if there is a problem, then we can see hypertonus, so pretty much increased tone in all four limbs, and you can see exaggerated movements. We're all a little bit familiar with this kind of exaggerated movements. When we see a hypermetric dog, we can recognize that. It's an easy thing to see from a distance, and just remember that this is more associated with this part of the cerebellum. Then we have the hemispheres, and we specifically refer to this part as pontocerebellum from an anatomical point of view, and that is mainly because it projects to the pons, which is a different part of the brain, more rostrally, and from there to different parts of the brain. So when there is a problem with the hemispheres, you expect asynergia, dysmetria, and you can see intention tremors. So asynergia and dysmetria, pretty much we just describe a different type of gait, which is not well coordinated, is more exaggerated. And the intention tremors, we're going to see some, later on in a few videos, is pretty much we're referring to tremors mainly affecting the head and the neck, the front part of the body, and they seem to be more obvious when an animal is trying to do something. So that's why it's called intention tremors. And of course we have the floculonodular lobe, the little lobe that we showed earlier. And this has mainly vestibular function. So this is what we call the vestibular cerebellum. And if there is a problem in that part of the cerebellum, you expect mainly vestibular signs. And they do have a peculiarity. And that's why normally when we have a problem there, we call it paradoxical vestibular syndrome, which we're going to discuss later. So how do we normally approach cerebellar problems? So if you think that you might have a problem with the cerebellum, you still need to have a very kind of, broad approach to these kind of, staircases. So you always, always start with a good history. It's very important that we ask the owners if there is any history of intoxication, if the dogs or cats are scavenging regularly. That is important because intoxications can cause cerebellar signs. But it's not only about the history about intoxication. Other important information that we can actually gain from the owners is what is the progression of them, of the clinical signs. Is it acute? Is it more chronic? Are they progressive, or are they improving, or are they just static? This is really important because you can rule in and rule out problems based on the history, and that will help you a lot on the kind of list of differentials that you're going to start creating later on. For example, if you have a paracute onset of a disease that is improving, that is less likely to be a neoplasia, and it will be much more likely to be something like an infarct. On the other hand, if you've got a very slowly progressive condition that progresses over, for example, 2 years, it will be very likely this condition to be an infarct, very unlikely to be an inflammatory or neoplastic disease, and it will be much more compatible with a neurodegenerative disease, something, for example, like amyotrophy or a different type of degeneration of the cerebellum. So that's why this information is quite important, and you should always try to gain as much information as you can from questioning the owners. And of course, after the history, is really important that we don't forget the physical examination. It's very easy to get distracted and excited when we see a dog with hypermetria, and we We concentrate on that, and then it's very easy for us to forget to perform a physical examination, feel the abdomen, see if there are any masses there, listen to the just the, to perform a good thoracic auscultation, try to see if there is any heart murmurs, because all these can contribute to secondary problems that will affect the cerebellum. For example, an abdominal mass or a dog or a cat that is affected by a cardiac disease is much more likely to develop infarcts. So if you do see an acute onset of cerebellar disease in an animal, then always, you know, do a good thorough physical examination to see if there is another cause that is contributing to this problem. And then, of course, you know, the exciting things for us neurologists and for you as well, it should be really just to perform a neurological examination. Many people get sometimes overwhelmed with a neurological examination, but it shouldn't be this way. If you follow some specific steps, which is exactly the same steps that I normally follow on a day-to-day basis, you can make the neurological examination much more simple. And I always follow this list, and I always start with mentation, and I expect that a dog with a cerebellar disease to have normal mentation. Of course, if there is a multifocal disease or if you're dealing with two problems at the same time, mentation might be affected by a different part of the brain, or by a different disease, for example, if there is systemic disease. But with purely cerebellar diseases, you don't expect any mentation changes. The posture is quite interesting. You can see what we call decerebellate posture, and this picture of the dog here on the right, you can see this dog has an increased tone of the thoracic limbs, and the pelvic limbs are a little bit more flexed, and they can have a little bit of a more random position. They're not very specific. This is what we call a decerebellate posture, and is normally associated with cerebellar disease. Of course, you can have other postural abnormalities like a head tilt if the vestibular system is involved, but at the same time, it could be completely normal. So some dogs with cerebellar disease, they don't have any postural abnormalities. Gait is, I think, is the most obvious thing that you're going to see with gait abnormalities. Is the most obvious thing that you're going to see with the cerebellar disease, and you may see ataxia, specifically cerebellar ataxia, which can be just manifested by a hypermetric gait. We all familiar to just dogs with hypermetria, and we always think, oh, this might be a cerebellar problem. Intention tremors, we shouldn't forget the intention tremors. This is part of the cerebellar ataxia as well. And of course, you could have some generalized tremors as well. Postural reactions is pretty much what we describe the assessment of proprioception, but not only. So pretty much is the paw positioning and the hopping. These are the main tests that we do for postural reactions. And they can be delayed with cerebellar diseases, and they can be delayed ipsilaterally, so on the same side. So if you suspect a dog that has a cerebellar disease and you expect that it's more likely to be on the right side, you expect the right side to have reduced postural reactions, reduced proprioception. Cranial nerves, you don't normally get specific cranial nerve deficits with a cerebellar disease, because it doesn't affect really, you know, the function of the cranial nerves. However, you can have some Menas deficits, because the Menas response pathway, it involves most of the brain, involves the forebrain, involves the brainstem and the cerebellum, because the cerebellum coordinates and fine-tunes this kind of movement to be able to blink. So if there is a cerebellar problem on the same side, you expect to get some deficits. Not always, and this you don't expect to see all the clinical signs in every cerebellar case, but if you do have Menas deficits and you suspect that it might be cerebellar, it would make sense, because the Menas pathway goes through the cerebellum as well. Of course, you could have nystagmus if the vestibular system is involved, mainly the floccular nodular lobe. And then when we move further down for the rest of the body, spinal reflexes, you don't expect them to be affected. Sometimes you might have increased tone with the cerebellar disease, and palpation of the spine is usually normal. You don't expect to find any discomfort. It would be very unlikely. Sorry for the typo. I just mentioned here unusually normal. Actually, usually is normal. You don't expect to find any abnormalities. And that is pretty much how you conclude to your neuroanatomical localization in the cerebellum. So All well and good. You have found that, okay, the cerebellum is affected in a case. Then what do you do next? So then it's really important that you come up with a list of differentials. And you might be bored of listening to neurologists mentioning this vitamin D all the time, but it's really, really important because it's very easy for people just to forget and just to concentrate on one differential or one group of differentials like a vascular disease or just a neoplastic disease. However, it's quite important that you actually follow this just to include all the differentials that you as much as you can include and have them all on the list. So V stands for vascular diseases. They can be common in the cerebellum, and infarcts or hemorrhages can be definitely just the common. Inflammatory or infectious diseases are also just the can be common. You can get idiopathic inflammatory diseases, or you can get infectious diseases. Mainly neosporosis is one of the most common ones, but parvovirus can affect cats as well, so we're going to talk a little bit about that on the next slide. You can have toxins. Mycotoxins can cause generalized tremors, and they can affect the cerebellum, and they can cause cerebellar ataxia, so that might not be uncommon to see. Anomalous diseases, like when there is a malformation of the brain, it can definitely be affecting the cerebellum, and one of them is the Dundee-Walker syndrome, in which syndrome you see the middle part of the cerebellum, mainly the vermis, being hypoplastic or completely aplastic. So it's just a congenital malformation, and that's how we describe it as Dundee-Walker, because they do have a very kind of specific kind of abnormal gait. Metabolic diseases are not really very common it's not common to see really cerebellar ataxia or cerebellar disease with metabolic diseases, but sometimes it can affect the whole body, including the cerebellum. Idiopathic diseases, there are many. One of them is, for example, the White Shaker syndrome, which is a type of an inflammatory disease that we're going to discuss later. We have a nice, interesting case with this condition, so we're going to talk a little bit about that in a few minutes. You can have, the N can start for nutritional, uncommon, but the N can start for neoplastic disease as well, and unfortunately neoplastic diseases can affect the cerebellum. And of course you can have the D for degenerative diseases like amyotrophy, and again degenerative diseases can affect the cerebellum like any other part of the body, and it's not uncommon to see them. But what do you expect with these conditions? You expect to be very slowly progressing over months and years. This is the typical characteristic of a neurodegenerative disease. So let's go and talk a little bit about cases now. I think we discussed enough about just the neuroanatomy and neurophysiology, and let's talk a little bit about cases, which is the most exciting part for us. So we're going to start with a very cute video. So we have Phoenix and Cosmo, and we're going to see this in a second. We're going to see Phoenix and Cosmo. There are 6 week old kittens, and you can see them here, and they try to walk. And you can see they presented with this ataxia that you can see just here on the video. You can see an exaggerated gait. You can see the kitten on the right having intention tremors, and the kitten on the left having this hypermetric kind of, can you see just now? This is beautiful there. You can see how the gait is hypermetric. And this is pretty much what you describe as cerebellar ataxia. So these kittens, we can play this video again. You can see they're ticking pretty much most of the boxes for cerebellar ataxia. They've got hypermetria, they've got intention tremors, and you can see at the same time they have a relatively normal mentation. You can see them; they're very curious. They're still playing. Fall. And these kittens had normal appetite, and you can see they're very keen to eat. So apart from the ataxia, which is quite dramatic in these ones, you don't really see any other abnormalities. So what you're going to do with these kittens? First of all, you perform your neurological examination. And you perform your just the physical examination, and the main finding from these two kittens is really that they have a cerebellar disease. So your neuroanatomical localization is really in the cerebellum because we haven't found any other abnormalities. And normally when you have young kittens with this kind of condition, you know, so with the cerebellar neurolocalization, always, always think of cerebellar hypoplasia due to feline pleukopenia virus. You might hear, you know, just the other vets, you know, might be just discussing, or they might be referring to cerebellar kittens. They are referring to this specific condition, and this condition normally is due to parvovirus infection in utero. So they are not, is unlikely that these kittens, they're going to be affected later, you know, after the birth. So normally it's an in utero infection that affects the kittens, and pretty much it causes hypoplasia of the cerebellum because this virus targets specific layers of the cerebellum, which leads to just hypoplasia. And then when they're born, already they've got a very hypoplastic cerebellum, and that is the reason of this ataxia. Can you test it? It's very difficult to test. So many, I receive phone calls regularly. How can you test, really, you know, to confirm this kind of, you know, infection in these kittens? Normally, whatever test you do, if you do serology or even PCR, it comes back negative because the virus normally affects them, the mother of the kitten, and the infection is in utero. By the time the kittens are born, they have developed some immunity, so it's unlikely that you're going to get a positive test by that time. So pretty much it's the after effect of that infection, so you only see the consequence. But what is important to diagnose these kittens is really the history. So just we're talking about young kittens, maybe unvaccinated mothers, and you look at the clinical picture, which is very characteristic. And the most important part is really lack of progression. If you do have progression of these clinical signs, then it's highly unlikely that is this condition, this cerebellar hypoplasia. So most of the times, if there is progression, there is a different disease, maybe FIP or a different kind of, you know, disease affecting them, the cerebellum, but unlikely to be this condition. So lack of progression is very good, and if anything, they get better. And this is really, you know, pretty much refers to the prognosis, which is relatively good in these kittens. They never go completely back to normal, but they compensate, and the gait can become just less ataxic. They learn how to balance themselves, and eventually they can have a completely normal life. But of course, you know, they always remain a little bit ataxic. They never go completely back to normal. So let's talk about the next case. So we discussed about the little cerebellar kittens. So let's talk a little bit about Bella. You're going to see Bella in a second. Bella is a four-year-old male neutered, actually female neutered, sorry for the typo there, golden retriever. And Bella presented to me just with 1 month history of progressive ataxia. So already it's an important just information, is progressive ataxia. So this is what we need to take really from the history. It's 1 month, so not very long history, kind of a subacute, kind of, you know, chronic history. Is progressing, and already the local vet had performed a hematology and biochemistry, which was normal. There were not any significant abnormalities. So this is Bella. We're gonna see Bella, and there she is, and she's trying to come out from her kennel, and you can see the mentation is very bright, and she's quite alert. She's very interactive. She's wagging her tail, but you can see she was hesitating there. And this is pretty much a typical sign of a cerebellar disease when they start hesitating and they start developing some intention tremor, which wasn't very obvious with Bella. But you're going to see her gait here. So you're going to see that she's a little bit reluctant to walk, she's ataxic, and you can see her thoracic limbs. This is a beautiful demonstration of hypermetria. You can see there is very nice hypermetria there, affecting mainly the thoracic limbs, but also the pelvic limbs as well. You can see she's a little bit unsteady. She's, you know, she doesn't like, you know, taking big steps because she feels that there is loss of a control of movement. And here you're going to see me performing some post-reaction test, and you can see that this poor positioning is delayed. It's not completely normal. You can see I'm doing it again and again, and that is not really normal. It's delayed. So we perform the post reactions in all four limbs. You can see that the thoracic limbs, they're not that affected. So mainly the pelvic limbs, which is just it's a typical example of what you expect to see, you know, with these cases. They don't tick every single box. So even though the poor positioning was relatively good in the thoracic limbs, you could see that when you try to do the hopping, which is again a test for the postural reactions, it doesn't seem to be responding 100%. So for me, that is a delayed hopping response. It's not nice and short and brisk as you would expect to be for a normal dog. So you can see really nicely that she's taking some time to hop, and that's what you expect to see with the delayed post reactions. On the other side, on the left side now, as we do it, you can see there's definitely delay. So pretty much just confirms what we what we suspected only from the pelvic limbs, that all four limbs are affected. And even though this one looks relatively good, we are pretty happy that all there are just saying that it was relatively good. That's why it's very good to repeat it, because you can see that in the last test it was a little bit delayed. And when you do postural reactions, always repeat them again and again, and try to combine a hopping just together with a poor positioning test to find out if there is any delay there or not. So what do we expect really, with this kind of, a neurological presentation? So based on that, neurological examination revealed mainly intention tremors, hypermetria, and if you need to localize this kind of, this condition, I would localize to the cerebellum. We had enough deficits there to localize it there. We reviewed the hematology biochemistry again, because the previous hematology biochemistry was done just a few weeks before, and there were no changes, so it remained normal. And then we proceeded to perform an MRI scan of the brain. And this is what we're going to show you now. So here you can see Bella's MRI scan. So this is Bella's MRI scan, and this is a normal scan. And remember, we just localized to the cerebellum. So this is the area of interest. You can see this is Bella's cerebellum, and this is how it looks normal. You can see the difference is quite striking. You don't tend to see so striking a kind of, the abnormalities actually when you see cerebellar diseases. And what do we see? We see lots of CSF around the cerebellum. There is a lot of white, which you don't expect to see, and the actual cerebellum looks quite atrophied. It looks quite small. Look at the volume of the cerebellum compared to the volume of the cerebellum here, which is normal. So based on this MRI scan, you have a generalized cerebellar atrophy, and that's all you can say. You cannot say anything more than that, but with what you see on the MRI, there is definitely atrophy there. And you would expect, then you do wonder if this is something that she was born with, or is it something that actually, is just that, it came up, lately, and, she's progressing. And I think some further testing will help us a little bit more. So if we move to the next slide, we're going to see that we performed a CSF tap and analysis, and this revealed mild mononuclear pleocytosis. So there were inflammatory changes there. So I always test these dogs for serology, for toxoplasma and neospora, and toxoplasma was negative. I always perform the IgG and IgM, and the reason I do that is because the immunoglobulins G, the IgG, normally they show previous exposure, so they're not very helpful for acute presentations. But the IgM, if they are positive, normally they show an active current infection. So that's why I always combine those two. So, but that was negative for Bella anyway. However, Neospora, we can only test for IgG, was quite positive, and it wasn't just marginally positive, it was positive in a dilution 1 in 800 or above that, which is a very high titer. So when you see that, is pretty much that is clinically, and from this serology result, pretty much we can conclude to a Neospora infection, which is pretty much what we describe as neosporosis. And What do we know about neosporosis? It's not very common. I know that people do test it a lot, but you're not gonna see much neosporosis out there. But it does become it just it does come in waves, and now because just raw diets are more kind of more common, we do see lately more neosporosis. And how do you get neosporosis if you're a dog? So pretty much you can have two different types of transmissions. One is the horizontal transmission, which pretty much it requires the dog to ingest raw meat or placenta of intermediate host, and intermediate hosts tend to be mainly herbivores, so cows, sheep, goats, pigs, and other kind of that mammals can be intermediate hosts. So pretty much they need to consume raw meat to contract Neospora. So this is the horizontal transmission. However, we can have vertical transmission as well from the mother to puppies, and pretty much puppies are born with Neospora. And to start with, you might not see any clinical signs in those puppies, but gradually, as they progress, you can see more and more clinical signs. The most useful test for us, especially, I think we perform serology. We do it all the time. It's quite useful, and I like it. But you can definitely perform PCR for Neospora and for Toxoplasma in the CSF. I don't find the PCR as sensitive as actually serology, because serology, you don't require to find the DNA of Neospora, which is pretty much what we need for the PCR and the CSF. I had cases where I was very, very convinced they had Neospora, and PCR in CSF was negative, but serology was very high, and everything else was very convincing. So ideally, you do both, but if you had to choose one, I would prefer serology. And what do you tend to see in this dog? So it's very peculiar because puppies, they're mainly affected in the pelvic limbs. So when you see a young puppy with a very stiff pelvic limb gait, and progressively the pelvic limbs, they're going to become rigid, permanently extended, and eventually they lose the use of those limbs. So always think of Neospora in puppies. That is the most typical presentation. We're talking about dogs below 6 months. That's when they normally present with pelvic limb abnormalities. So always remember that and test it. And in adult dogs, it's completely different presentation. It tends to affect the cerebellum. We don't know why there is this predilection for the cerebellum, but that's where you tend to see it actually the most. But of course, it can affect any part of the body, the rest of the brain and the muscles and the nerves. So it can cause any part of the body can be affected. But the cerebellum definitely, there is the most dramatically affected by this condition. So how do you treat, once you diagnose Neospora, how do you treat it? The best actually treatment that we can try is really clindamycin or trimethoprim sulfonamides. So normally you're going to see that the clindamycin dose I've got here, it's much, much higher than actually you see in formularies for different kind of conditions. So we normally go for 20 mg per kg twice a day, and we give that per os. If you go for trimethoprim sulfonamide, we prefer to combine that with pyrimethamine, and we add some folic acid as well, just because pyrimethamine can actually cause a folic acid deficiency. And so that's why we combine these drugs. Remember though, if you're going to treat a dog with trimethoprim sulfonamide, remember that this can cause actually keratoconjunctivitis, Zika, as a side effect. So always keep an eye on these dogs' eyes. For how long? That's a very good question. We don't really know. The majority of these kind of cases, they're treated between, 3 and 6 months, and then we try to stop the treatment and see what happens. And so the treatment needs to be very long. So don't think that you're going to give, clindamycin or trimethoprim sulfonamide for 2 weeks and then you're going to stop it. It's very, very unlikely that you're going to treat the disease. So we need at least 3 to 6 months of treatment. And unfortunately, we have seen lots of cases where even after that period of time of treatment, you stop it, and then a few months later, they have a relapse, so they need to go back again on the same treatment. So that's pretty much what you need to know about Neospora. So we can talk about our third case now. So let's talk about Twiglet. Twiglet is one of my favorite breeds. It's a Dachshund. It's a 3-year-old male neutered Dachshund, and presented to me with a 1 week history of mild head tremors, which progressed to generalized tremors, and everyone was worried because it wasn't very specific initially, but progressively you're going to see that this dog has actually developed more generalized tremors. We're going to see the video in a second. And already we had some information that this dog was tested for Toxoplasma neospora, which was negative. So we knew that all that already that was out of the differential list. And hematology biochemistry was normal. They didn't find anything significant abnormal there. So let's go and see little Twiglet. He's a very cute little Dachshund, and here it is. So you can see he doesn't walk very much, and that is part of his problem. And you can see that the tremors are not the most obvious, but unfortunately this is what you get really with cerebellar kind of conditions. You don't get the most obvious clinical signs, but what you can see, there is a little bit of reluctance to walk, and he's pacing a little bit. And you're gonna see we try to stimulate him a little bit to walk, but you can see that the tremors are very fine, but you can see it around his head here. There is a very, very fine generalized tremor, and you can see that he's balancing a little bit. You can see a little bit of just an intention head tremor as well. And when you see his body, he's just there. You can see that he doesn't really stay in one place. So, and the tremors, they're not the most obvious tremors, but that's what you can get actually with this condition, which we're going to discuss in a little bit. So very fine tremors. If you concentrate a lot, you're going to see more and more of this. And you can see there is a bit of reluctance to walk. There is a little bit of intention head tremor, and the whole body is swaying from one side to the other side. So not any typical signs of hypermetria. You don't really see anything else apart from these just generalized tremors. So let's talk a little bit about this presentation. So this is a typical presentation for this condition. So when you see a case like this, you always think that, okay, we have generalized tremors. You think either systemic disease. If there's not really a systemic disease, then we concentrate more on the cerebellum. And that was the neuroanatomical localization in this dog based on these tremors. We didn't find anything else abnormal in the neurological examination. So my localization was cerebellum. So then what do we tend to do? Yeah, of course, we're going to need to perform an MRI scan. And you don't always have to do an MRI scan, but in these cases, it does help. And we did perform an MRI scan on Twiglet, and it was normal. So, which doesn't really help you that much, but it's good in a way that it doesn't help us to rule in a condition, but it does help us to rule out problems. And at least I know that the cerebellum didn't have any size abnormalities. I didn't see any obvious tumors or any other kind of cerebellar lesions. So I know that I have ruled out lots of different kind of, diseases there, but unfortunately still we don't know what is causing actually these tremors. The CSF revealed mild lymphocytic pleocytosis. So already we get some clues that there might be something inflammatory going on in the cerebellum and in the rest of the CNS. And this is pretty much what you get with this condition. So my diagnosis was really idiopathic tremors, or you can also see it idiopathic cerebellitis, or it's also more widely known as white shaker syndrome. So this is a term that I don't really like that much because everyone thinks, oh, if it's a white shaker syndrome, it will be a white dog. But as you could see, Twiglet demonstrated that really well, that he wasn't white at all. He's black. So any color can be affected. Any breed can be affected as well. And all they show is this fine generalized tremors, which initially you really struggle to find them just to see really what is wrong, with these cases. They're not very specific. The owners report that, okay, my dog is shaking a little bit more than usual, which of course can be very unspecific. They can be shaking because it's cold. They can be shaking because they're nervous. So anything potentially could cause the generalized tremors. But what is interesting with these cases is that actually they progress. So they start with a little bit of a fine tremor. It gets worse and worse and worse. And this is pretty much what is, just telling you, okay, the cerebellum might be affecting this dog if these tremors are progressing. And they tend to progress over about a few days to 1 week. So what do we do with these cases? We don't really know exactly what is causing it, but we believe that there might be an inflammatory response. So we normally give them steroids. So, and they tend to respond very well to immunosuppressive treatment. So overall, prognosis is good in these cases. And pretty much, you know, just to summarize, this condition, as we described it earlier, is called white shaker syndrome or idiopathic cerebellitis or idiopathic tremors. We use all these terms for exactly the same problem. And it tends to affect small dogs and young dogs. So it's mainly dogs below 15 kilos and below the age of 6. But of course, you can see it in any breed and any age. The color, as we discussed earlier, don't get confused with a white, you know, shaker. It can be any color. And I must admit, I've seen it mainly in non-white dogs rather than actually white dogs. So any color can be affected. And as we discussed earlier, the pathophysiology, we don't really know what is causing it. These dogs, they don't tend to get a PM, so it's extremely unlikely that you're going to get a histopathology on these dogs. And we don't really know exactly what is causing it. So we presume that it might be an idiopathic inflammatory disease that is causing this condition. And treatment options, as we discussed earlier, is mainly prednisolone. And we start at a dose of 2 milligrams per kilogram just per day. And then very gradually, you can start reducing the dose. And the less likely they're going to relapse. They don't tend to relapse that often. And I normally treat them for about 6 months on a tapering dose. And then they can go completely back to normal. So it's a good disease to treat because you see a relatively quick response as soon as you start the steroids. And then eventually, they do well. So this is about really the white shaker syndrome. Let's go and see Faith now. So let's go to case 4. Faith is a 9-year-old female neuter greyhound. She presents to me with a sudden onset of ataxia, paracute onset, and she was leaning towards the left side. When I performed the neurological examination, I found a normal mentation. She was very bright and alert, a bit stressed, but normal mentation. She had a hypermetria affecting pretty much mainly all her limbs. She had delayed postural reactions on the left. We had normal spinal reflexes. The cranial nerves revealed absent menace response on the left as well. So already you've got a little bit of a side there. So you know that the left on the left side, the postural reactions were delayed. Menace response was absent, where it was normal on the other side. And we had normal palpebral reflexes and PLRs. So, and when I palpated the spine, she was comfortable. So based on that, my neuroanatomical localization was cerebellum and mainly on the left side. Remember, we said that the lesions, they tend to be ipsilaterally when it comes to the cerebellum. So then we proceeded with further investigation, and this is Faith MRI scan. So what we can see here, we can see that the front part, the rostral part of the cerebellum, it seems to be very hyperintense. So this is a sagittal T2 view, and you can see that there is definitely a problem there where I've got the arrow. When we look at the transverse section, it's a very well-defined lesion, and you can see it here from on the dorsal view. So it's very small, it's very well-defined, and I didn't have any contrast uptake. When we gave the contrast, there wasn't any obvious contrast uptake. There wasn't any perilesional changes, and there wasn't any obvious mass effect. You can see that the cerebellum doesn't look swollen. It just looks normal size, but you do have this very well-defined lesion. So what do you expect? When you see this kind of very well-defined lesion, the first thing that you suspect is really a cerebellar infarct. And this one specifically, a rostral cerebellar ischemic infarct, because we didn't have any signs of hemorrhage there. So whenever you see that, okay, you've got a good diagnosis, you are happy as much as you can, you know, diagnose. Of course, the confirmation comes from histopathology, but you cannot do that. So you just go with what you've got. So it's a presumptive diagnosis of an ischemic infarct. And you always need to see if there is an underlying cause. So the diagnosis of an infarct is one part, but the other part, try to find if there is an underlying cause. So I would always look for hematological and endocrine abnormalities like hypothyroidism and Cushing's. Check for renal disease because they can lose antithrombin 3, which you can measure that. You can measure that in the urine. And if there is a lot of a loss, you know, big loss of antithrombin 3, they go into a hypercoagulable state and they're much more predisposed to develop infarcts. You can have cardiac disease, of course. That's why we said a good physical examination is very important. You can perform an echo, just and you can perform an ECG. You can check for hypertension. Hypertension definitely can lead to infarcts. And of course, you can check for paraneoplastic diseases. So perform some thoracic radiographs and an abdominal ultrasound scan to see if there is an underlying cause. So we did all these tests with Faith. We didn't find anything abnormal, which is not a surprise because about 50% of these cases with infarct, you find an underlying cause. But in the rest 50%, you don't really find an underlying cause. So we assume it was just a spontaneous infarct. And these spontaneous infarcts tend to happen more in Greyhounds and in the Cavalier King Charles Spaniels. They tend to be overrepresented. We don't quite know exactly why these breeds, they tend to be more overrepresented. With the Cavaliers, we believe that might be a thrombocytopathia. With them, they've got this kind of microplatelets. But again, we don't really know if this is the problem or not. But if you don't find an underlying cause, then you just normally support them with physiotherapy. The recovery tends to be slow, but they tend to improve. And initially, the clinical presentation might be very dramatic, but they improve quite quickly. And with regards to treatment, we don't really give anything specific. Don't try to give steroids. You can only make things worse in these kind of cases. So if you find an underlying cause, treat it. Otherwise, just perform only physiotherapy. And if you've got relapsing kind of infarct, then I tend to give clopidogrel for prophylactic treatment. And the dose is around 2 to 4 milligrams per kilogram per os every 24 hours. Does it prevent it completely? No, unfortunately, because we don't really know exactly what predisposes these dogs to these infarcts. It doesn't prevent completely, but it might help a little bit, or it might reduce the frequency of these infarcts. So remember then, paracute onset, and normally, they've got a history that they're improving. It's a typical presentation of a cerebellar infarction. So let's move to the next case, which is really, the peanut. Peanut is a Scottish Terrier presented with 1 year history of a slowly progressive ataxia. She was normal otherwise, still very active. But the important thing here is 1 year history of ataxia. Vet had performed already hematology biochemistry, which was normal, and she was tested for Toxoplasma neospora, which was negative. So already they had done a good investigation from that point of view. And here we can see little peanut. So we're going to see the video coming up. It should be with us in a second. And here we've got peanut. You're going to see peanut walking outside. And what can we see? We can see already from a distance. I think it's really helpful, this video, because you can see a nice hypermetria. Sorry, you might just need to just zoom in a little bit on your screens to see the hypermetria, especially with the short little legs. But you can see there is a little bit of ataxia. It's swaying a little bit from one side to the other side. And you can see a very good demonstration of hypermetria. Look, those thoracic limbs, they're overreaching. And there is this kind of, high stepping gait. So when you see that, you always think, okay, hypermetric gait in a normal otherwise dog. Probably the neurological examination is going to be consistent with a cerebellar disease. So then what do you perform? We had already hematology biochemistry normal. We had Toxoplasma neospora normal or negative. So then the next step would be to perform an MRI scan. And this is what we found on the MRI scan. You can see we've got the cerebellum is a little bit just atrophied. You can see more CSF around it. You can see more white than you would expect. This is peanut cerebellum, and this is a normal dog cerebellum. You can see the cerebellum has much more tissue there in a normal dog, less in peanut, and we didn't really find any other abnormalities. So a mildly atrophied kind of, cerebellum. That's all we found. So when we perform a CSF tap, it was just the CSF analysis was normal. So we concluded, because the history was going on over a year and Peanut was relatively young, that the most likely possibility it was cerebellar cortical abiotrophy or degeneration. Unfortunately, this is a diagnosis you can make only on post-mortem examination, but presumptive diagnosis, it can be done based on imaging and ruling out other conditions. cerebellar abeotrophy, it can have an early onset in mainly in Labradors, Irish Setters, Samoyed, and other breeds, but we can have a late onset like we have here with Peanut in dogs over, you know, say about, you know, 2 or 3 years of age, like in Scottish Terriers, Gordon Terriers, Old English Sheepdogs, and Staffordshire Bull Terriers. So these tend to have more of a late onset, and again, remember that the progression is very, very slow over years. It's a very slowly progressive disease. Unfortunately, there's no treatment. There's nothing you can do for these dogs. And eventually, they do progress to the point where they cannot walk properly anymore. And unfortunately, owners decide to put them to sleep because there's nothing else you can do to help them. So it's a neurodegenerative disease. There, for some breeds, there is a DNA testing, so you can check and see. If there is a DNA test available, you can perform it, and it might help you a little bit more with the diagnosis. So let's see Lily now. So Lily, it's our sixth case for today. I hope you all follow me. You haven't fallen asleep. So let's see what we see with Lily. Lily was a 10-year-old large breed dog, mixed kind of, you know, breed. She had a 6-week history of progressive ataxia. She had a head tilt to the left and a hypermetric gait to the right, which is an interesting finding already. Hematology biochemistry was normal. Serology for Toxoplasma neospora was negative. So what we found on the neurological examination, we found that the head tilt definitely was to the left, and she was leaning to that side, and she did have a hypermetric gait on the right, so that's interesting, already on the opposite side. The postural reactions were delayed on the right side, and we had Meniere's deficits on the right again, and normal on the left, and she had intact palpebral reflexes and papillary light reflexes. Segmental spinal reflexes were normal. Spinal palpation didn't reveal any abnormalities, no discomfort. So based on that, my neuroanatomical localization was on the right cerebellum because we had right postural reaction deficits, and the Meniere's response was absent or inconsistent on the right. And that fits with that. What doesn't really fit is really the left head tilt. And this is where we come with a more specific anatomical localization of paradoxical vestibular syndrome. So you can localize it to the right cerebellum with the paradoxical left head tilt. So this is, you might have heard of the paradoxical vestibular syndrome or vestibular disease. It's, we do see it every now and then, and definitely gets neurologists quite excited because it has some peculiarities there. And unfortunately for Lily, we performed an MRI scan, and we found that on the right side of her cerebellum, you can see here the arrows pointing at this kind of, you know, well-defined lesion. This lesion didn't uptake any contrast, and unfortunately, the most likely diagnosis, differential diagnosis really for her, it was a neoplastic disease, and glioma was the most likely possibility for her. So options, unfortunately, they're very limited for this kind of gliomas. They don't tend to respond very well to radiation therapy. And even if you do try to radiate the cerebellum, normally then, you know, then you can have some side effects associated with the cerebellar destruction or brainstem dysfunction. So we decided palliative treatment with prednisolone, just a low dose of prednisolone. But unfortunately, prognosis is poor. These dogs continue to deteriorate, and eventually they're euthanized because they don't respond to any other form of treatment. Other common cerebellar forms of tumors you can see is meningioma. You can get that. Sometimes you can remove them. Gliomas, lymphoma, medulloblastoma tends to affect young dogs. And of course, you can get choroid plexus tumors. They are just underneath. They start from underneath the cerebellum. So these are pretty much the most common tumors that you can get. And that was what happened with Lily. So let's talk very briefly about paradoxical vestibular syndrome. So this is a lesion that is affecting the flocculo nodular lobe of the cerebellum. It's the ventral part of the cerebellum. You see mainly vestibular signs on the ipsilateral to the lesion. However, the head tilt tends to be on the opposite side. And this is the paradoxical part, is that normally with vestibular diseases, you tend to see the head tilt on the same side, but if it is paradoxical vestibular disease, the head tilt is on the other side. So then the cerebellum, and that is happening, how do we explain that? It's because the normal side, which is really, you know, the side of the head tilt, becomes weaker. Normally when you have vestibular disease, the weaker side shows the head tilt, but in these cases, the affected side of the cerebellum increases the tone in the body because the cerebellum has mainly an inhibitory role, and the affected side increases tone. So the non-affected side, it seems a bit weaker because it has normal tone, and this is how we get a head tilt towards the weaker side of the body, which is the normal side, and that's how you normally get the vestibular signs. So you may get confused with all this, but you don't need to get into the details of really of this kind of, you know, the pathophysiology of the vestibular disease. But when you suspect paradoxical vestibular syndrome, when you see a head tilt to one side, when you see cerebellar signs, and when you see posterior reaction deficits on the opposite side, so when proprioception is reduced on the opposite side to the head tilt, okay, this is a paradoxical vestibular syndrome. And the side of the lesion is normally the side of the posterior reaction deficits. That's how you normally find it out. I hope I haven't really confused you with all this. So we do have a time for a last video, and this is going to be a very cute video. So you're going to see this in a second. So I'm going to present you Aria, which is our last case for today. This is a 7-month-old female entire pug, and presented to me with an episodic head tremor, which is very, you know, easy for people to, you know, assume that this is a head tremor. Probably there is a cerebellar problem there. But this was a little bit of a peculiar head tremor. It was mainly at rest. So she was responsive during these episodes. She didn't have any other abnormalities. She was appeared very normal. And the referring vets had performed already hematology, biochemistry, bile acids were all normal. So let's see little Aria and see what she does. So there she is. And so you can see here she's very cute, and all you can see this is that she's resting, so she doesn't try to do anything, and she has this kind of head bobbing towards one side and the other side, and you can see she doesn't have any other, she's still very responsive, she's looking around, she doesn't try to do anything, but it's more a resting head tremor, and you can see here very well we don't see any other abnormalities. And pretty much you can see this head tremor from one side to the other side, like she does now, but you can also see it as a nodding kind of, you know, head tremor. So you can see actually dogs nodding up and down, and this can be very, very similar. So this is pretty much what we had really for Aria. You know, her neurological examination when she came to see me was completely normal, and we didn't really find any other abnormalities between those episodes of this tremor. She was completely normal, which is the first thing that I was thinking, okay, if she's normal between the episodes of tremor, it's less likely to be a cerebellar problem. But it's definitely a good differential because there is head tremor there. But if she's normal between the episodes, unlikely to be a cerebellar problem. So my most likely differential for this dog, it was really idiopathic head tremors or head bobbing, which is really a very common problem, not problem, it's a very common condition in a brachycephalic breeds, and you can see it in Dobermans. It can be observed at rest or sedated dogs, so when they try to fall asleep, you can see this kind of intermittent tremor. As soon as you stimulate them with a toy or a treat, it tends to stop and they start standing and they go completely back to normal again. And they are completely opposite to intention tremors, which is what you see with the cerebellar diseases. So, of course, it may look like a cerebellar problem, but it's not a cerebellar problem. And it remains idiopathic. We don't really know exactly what is causing this kind of, you know, idiopathic head tremors or head bobbing. But the good news is that they don't really affect the dog's quality of life. They remain completely normal otherwise. They have a completely normal life expectancy, and unfortunately there's no treatment. We believe that it might be a muscular or a tendon kind of, you know, problem. We don't really know exactly what is causing this problem, but they don't respond to any antiepileptic treatment. It's not a seizure, and overall, you know, all you need to do is really educate people and the owners about this condition. No one needs to panic about them. There's no need for antiepileptic treatment, and normally they have a very good, you know, outcome. Some dogs, they might come out of these kind of tremors as they get older. Some other dogs might change a little bit, the frequency might increase, and some other dogs might remain static throughout their whole lives. So not a cerebellar disease per se, this one, but it was a good example to see that you can get some tremors where they may look like a cerebellar disease, but actually is not a cerebellar problem. And this was the last slide, and I will be happy to hear any questions, and I'm more than happy to just there to help you. Or I hope you're feeling a little bit more comfortable now with with the cerebellar diseases, and we might have time for just for one or two questions. We do have three more minutes. Okay, we do have one question. So one just we have one question. It's about really how do you confirm the White Shaker syndrome? So remember, it was the syndrome actually that Twiglet had, is the little Dachshund, and unfortunately, it's not easy to confirm these conditions, and it's very difficult for us as well to actually confirm them. But you normally go by excluding other problems. And you try to just rule out as much as you can, and you go by the history as well. So when you have a generalized tremors that are progressive, you have normal imaging, sometimes abnormal or normal CSF, you rule out Toxoplasma neospora, and you have good response to steroids. This is pretty much what you know. That is enough information for a presumptive diagnosis of this White Shaker syndrome. But actually, no other test that you can actually confirm. So it's more a diagnosis of ruling it out, but you cannot actually rule it in. There's nothing to confirm it to rule it in, but you just try to rule out other conditions and go by what you have. So it's a presumptive diagnosis. And just a final question. We may have one more minute for the final question. I can see it's one more. Okay. So the final question is really if we can, if cats can get Neospora and if I normally test them. So, normally, they don't get Neosporum, so it's a disease that doesn't really affect the cats. Experimentally, they have actually infected cats with Neospora, but they haven't actually developed any significant clinical signs. So, routinely, I don't test cats for Neospora. They don't actually get it under normal, natural circumstances. So, the answer is no, I don't test cats for Neospora, just only Toxoplasma. Okay, so I think I think the time might be up, and thank you. I just want to thank you for your attention. I hope I didn't bore you too much with with my talk, and I hope you feel a little bit more comfortable now about diagnosing cerebellar conditions.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Johnny for an excellent presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.